right, Hijazi versus McDade, Mr. Bartolomucci.
May it please the court, Chris Bartolomucci for petitioner Ali Hijazi. Mr. Hijazi has been under indictment for 43 months, yet the district court...
So that raises a question in my mind about your litigation strategy, which baffles me. So the only issues involving the dismissal of the indictment are issues of law, right?
That's correct.
Issues of law. So why is it that... So in your opening brief, you don't argue that we should order the indictment dismissed, but you summarize the arguments that you made in the district court. But you don't argue. You just summarize. Then the government doesn't respond on the merits, and then you say in your reply brief, oh, by the way, we might as well decide the case. That's ridiculous.
Judge Posner, I would...
What's going on? You can either argue, you can tell us it's a pure issue of law, we should end this litigation, since, as you say, your client is under this cloud, been under the cloud for years.
Judge Posner, if I may...
Sending it back to the district court.
We do ask this court to dismiss the indictment.
Why didn't you say that in your opening brief?
We did.
No, you didn't. You
yes,
just summarized
with
the
respect,
arguments.
It's the final argument section in our brief. It appears on... approximately pages 29 or 30. We expressly
yeah,
asked this
I'm
court.
Wrong, so.
With
I mean, you don't spend as much time on that, but I think your argument, as just I read it, suggests that all of the jurisdictional and other points you've made, in fact, are the legal reasons to dismiss the
oh,
indictment.
Oh, see, you know what I misunderstood? When you said at the end the court should proceed to consider the merits of Mr. Hijazi's motion to dismiss. I thought you meant we should ask you to brief these issues.
Well no, to be perfectly...
What you say in your brief is that you're summarizing the issues you made in the district court.
We did summarize the issues, and then in the
you
final section...
your arguments in the district court.
I think if you look in the relief requested, which is on the first or second page of the petition, we asked the court... either to dismiss order the district court to dismiss the indictment outright, or in the alternative, to order the district court to rule on the motion to dismiss. And then in the final section of our brief, we present an express argument in favor of this court considering the merits
but
of.
Look at your. Maybe I'm being petty, but look at your table of contents. You don't say anything about your table of contents that the district court erred.
Judge Posner,
you said they have a duty to decide.
Well, we make two arguments, and Judge Posner, with respect, I think they're very plainly stated. The final argument section of the brief very clearly states that we would like the court to consider the merits underlying the motion to dismiss.
The alternative should order to dismiss. That argument section consists of, like, less than a page, right?
That's all that was necessary to make the argument.
What do you mean it's all that's necessary to make the argument?
Well, the argument consists of advising...
Better still, the court should order the court below dismiss the indictment with prejudice. But you don't give any argument as to why it should be dismissed.
Yes, we do. No, you don't. Well, Judge Posner, the motion to dismiss presents the arguments for dismissal.
Usually, we're on a petition for mandamus. Well, look, usually people, an appellant does not say, for the reason, the appellant's brief, they'd be very short if it said, for the reasons we argued in the district court, we'd like you to reverse, right? They don't say that. They make the argument.
Well, we're here not on appeal, but on a petition for mandamus.
What difference does that make?
It does make a difference.
You're here on an appeal?
No, sir. No, Judge Tinder. We're here on a petition for mandamus. And the first question for the court is whether it should direct the district court to rule on Mr. Hijazi's motion to dismiss. we request that relief. And then in the alternative, which is the more far-reaching relief, we ask the court, since these are legal issues, why not go straight to the merits and consider them?
Isn't that beyond what a mandamus should be? Mandamus should direct the court with jurisdiction to act if it refuses to act.
Yes, and there are two ways the court could direct the district court to act. You could either direct the district court to rule on the motions, or you could simply direct the district court to dismiss the indictment. So there are two types of relief. We have requested both of them. I think our petition very clearly asks for both kinds of relief.
But your argument section contains no argument for the broader relief.
No, that's not correct. We point out that these are legal.
That's correct.
We point out that these are legal issues.
Page 30, you don't have any argument on page 30.
We cite a couple of circuit cases in which they have dismissed indictments.
The merits are complicated.
Maybe we could turn to the jurisdictional question, and I am interested in knowing whether it makes any difference, as the government has suggested, that the kind of extraterritorial jurisdiction you're objecting about is a matter fundamentally of legislative jurisdiction rather than classic federal court subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, as the Supreme Court recognized in Arbaugh, jurisdiction is a word that encompasses a variety of things. I don't think we're using jurisdiction in the hardcore Article 3 sense, that is the type of argument that you could not raise in the district court and then raise on appeal.
Jurisdiction at all. You're just talking about a situation where you're stymied in the district court, as the district judge won't rule.
No, I believe Judge Wood is talking about the extraterritorial issue.
Of course. But in terms of your reason for wanting mandamus, is the district judge is refusing to rule. Right?
Correct. I think Judge Wood's question goes to whether the extraterritorial issue is jurisdictional.
Right. In a sense, why is it that you're telling the district court that it should not entertain this case? Because that does get to issues of the question of the scope of U.S. law, whether U.S. law is regulating everything that happens in Kuwait as well as everywhere else, whether there's personal jurisdiction over this defendant. So those would be the things that you would be saying either to us or to the district court.
And that we have said to the district court.
And I actually was interested to know, I guess you've already had a bit of that discussion, whether there are any facts whatsoever in dispute that would be better entrusted to the district court to develop.
I don't believe so. It's undisputed that all of Mr. Hijazi's conduct or alleged conduct occurred in Kuwait. It's not disputed that Mr. Hijazi has not even been.
I'm not so sure that's undisputed, though. Doesn't the government argue that he aided and abetted the other fellow doing certain things here, and that there was some email traffic that came within the jurisdiction, the geographic jurisdiction of the court?
There is an aiding and abetting claim, but that would be from Kuwait. It's not alleged that Mr. Hijazi did anything in the United States. The indictment does allege that he sent a couple of emails.
Sounds like a pretty fact-specific determination that would have to be made.
But wait, you can't challenge an indictment on factual grounds. Unless you were saying that the grand jury had been corrupted or something.
But we haven't.
Right? So you have to accept all the factual assertions in the indictment. Right?
And we have. And yeah. There's no allegation.
It includes that there was a consequence in the United States.
But that is different. A consequence in the United States is different from conduct in the United States. The extraterritoriality question goes to whether the law applies to conduct that takes place overseas, outside of the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And the indictment does not allege, and it is not disputed, that all of Mr. Hijazi's alleged conduct occurred in Kuwait. So the extraterritorial.
I'm a little curious about the facts that you've submitted, or lack of facts, regarding the effect of the presence of the indictment on your client. For example, you've alleged that he is a resident of Kuwait.
Correct.
But you haven't alleged what his citizenship is or given any affidavit for him about how this restricts his travels.
You say
he can't go visit his father in some unspecified country. You haven't given us any facts that would show what country that is and why that country would restrict or turn him over to us if he got there. There's a lot that's not known.
Well, Judge Tinder, in the Marion case, the Supreme Court indicated that being under indictment for an extended period of time necessarily impacts a defendant's liberty, his livelihood, and his reputation. And I would think that as a matter of law, if you are under indictment for 43 months, that cannot help but impact your liberty, livelihood, and reputation.
Now, is there actually something in the record? Because I noticed that the district court does refer to Mr. Hijazi as a Kuwaiti citizen, not just a resident.
That's the
first page of the district court's order.
Yet the ambassador's letter to the United States refers to him only as a resident, not as a citizen.
Mr. Hijazi is a citizen of the Lebanon who is a longtime resident of Kuwait. The magistrate judge's report and recommendation makes a finding that he is a resident of Kuwait.
The magistrate judge says he's a citizen of Kuwait, as does the district court judge, but you're now telling us that's wrong. He's really a citizen.
He's actually a citizen of the Lebanon. But
And is that where he wants to visit?
I think he'd like to be able to leave Kuwait. The fact is that the government has issued an Interpol red notice, which is essentially an arrest warrant issued to all Interpol countries.
So I understand you argue the fugitivity disentitlement doesn't apply to your client, but how is your client different than a fugitive?
He's not a fugitive because he never fled. He never escaped from custody.
In terms of him litigating a criminal case in U.S. court, how is he any different than a fugitive attempting to do that?
Well, because to be a fugitive, one must flee. One must engage in some wrongful act, be it escaping from custody, hiding, fleeing the jurisdiction. Mr. Hijazi has not been convicted of anything. He retains the presumption of innocence, and he's merely absent from the United States.
Well, and he submitted himself to the Kuwaiti authorities, did he not?
That's correct.
Well, could he be tried in absentia?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
The American Constitution doesn't permit that, and neither do the federal rules of criminal procedure. As this court noted in the Marshall case, mere absence from the jurisdiction.
That would help you, actually, if he could, right? That would create more mutuality.
And it would allow you to get that motion ruled on.
I believe it's a moot point. I don't think he can't be tried in absentia under American law. And he's not a fugitive. The district court specifically found that. The government doesn't contend that he is a fugitive.
But again, how is he different than a fugitive in trying to litigate his case before he's there?
Does a fugitive
have some duty to appear before the court? I mean, it seems to me all the cases that have been cited have involved U.S. citizens or people who started out in the United States and then left.
That's absolutely correct. And Mr. Hijazi has no duty to be in the United States or come to the United States. There's no extradition treaty between the two countries. His own government opposes the prosecution and believes there's no jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court's Barker case.
You say no, but if Kuwait wanted, it could ship him off to the United States, couldn't it?
I believe it probably could, but the Kuwaiti government believes the United States has no jurisdiction in this matter and has not turned over.
That helps you. I'm trying to help you. Because the question is there any, would he be taking any risks? Is he taking any risk by bringing this proceeding, this mandamus? I think he is. Because if he asks for the indictment to be dismissed, and if we ruled in a district court and we affirmed that, in fact, it's a perfectly good indictment, this is an extraterritorial statute and so on, then we go to Kuwait and say, you don't have an extradition treaty, but look, there's a valid statute, you're our ally, we're friends, your oil, we'd really like you to send this guy back. And so wouldn't his position be considerably worse off if he loses this case?
I think that's right, and I think it refutes the district court's notion that there was no mutuality. The entire basis for the district court's ruling is that he has nothing to lose, but that's really not the case. If he gets an adverse ruling on his motion to dismiss, I think that certainly does impact him in a negative and concrete way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bartolomucci. Mr. Walters? me ask you before you begin. Have you discussed this case with the Justice Department in Washington?
Yes, Your Honor. Pre-indictment, post-indictment.
No, the position you take on whether the district judge should rule on this.
I can explain to you what I did as far as when we first took the position of whether to move to hold it in abeyance, or initially we actually moved to strike with leave to resubmit upon arraignment. I did discuss with people within my chain of command. Now, whether that was first discussed with people within the Department of Justice, I do not know. I spoke to my U.S. attorney. But I can tell you that the Department of Justice, Maine Justice, has been involved in this litigation from the beginning, pre-indictment, through the indictment, and now.
Because there is a foreign policy dimension here, right? Our relations with Kuwait. Kuwait is an ally, and they have some kind of interest in this matter if they're not surrendering him to us.
I agree that Kuwait's an ally, and there are international dimensions to it.
And hard cases can make bad law. This mandamus issue could have broad effect, well beyond this case. And you've tried this case twice already without a verdict.
We have tried it twice without a verdict.
It's looking like a pretty tough case.
It is a difficult case.
Is this a case that you want to risk the U.S. position in getting the ruling?
I'm trying to understand the question. Risk our position versus with respect to what, Your Honor? Asking the court not to rule?
Risking that the ruling on the mandamus would be adverse to your position.
On the merits?
Right.
Your Honor, let me address that. It would be quite unique for the petitioner's brief to be considered a brief on the merits. I am unaware of any briefing procedure before this court where you can take the substantive part of your argument and put it in an appendix. It was our understanding that...
Well, it's in Part 4 if it's there, but I think that's not the only thing that's unusual about this case. It's rather stunning that the government has not in any way tried to address the merits of these jurisdictional issues. And I can tell you that there are a lot of things. Mr. Hijazi, for example, is quite correct that if he were to go to a country that does have an extradition treaty with the United States, almost all extradition treaties have an exception for one's own citizens, but they're happy to extradite anybody else. And the United States almost never signs an extradition treaty that obligates us to send a U.S. citizen to another country, and these things tend to be reciprocal. So he almost certainly would be extradited to the United States if he were to leave Kuwait. On top of that, the extraterritoriality issues are very serious ones, and you have not in your brief cited a single case that looks anything like this, certainly not Justice Douglas's Chambers opinion, which couldn't be further from this, and Chambers opinions aren't opinions of the court anyway. So I'm very surprised that the government hasn't had more to say about this.
Your Honor, if I may, first, in looking at, we have to take into account what's really been argued before the court. What's the primary relief that they have asked for in 29 of the 30 pages?
And the classic relief that you ask for in mandamus in a case where a district judge has been sitting on something forever is to get the district judge to rule. And I am sure that if that's what we decided to order, they'd be more than happy to send it back. I think Judge Posner's question, and actually, frankly, I was thinking of this too, is what's the point? I mean, are there, in fact, facts that you can suggest that a district court needs to find before this is ripe for consideration?
Well, we would like the opportunity to fully brief the
merits.
That's
briefing, but what needs to happen? Why didn't you brief it already?
Within the page limitation given and the amount of time that was devoted to their primary request, which was to send this back to the district court with an order directing the court and then to enter an order.
So why do you think waiting forever is a good idea?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why do you think that waiting permanently is a good litigation?
We aren't pleased with waiting permanently, Your Honor. But we do believe that there needs to be reciprocity or reciprocal obligations. Because
suppose you were indicted in Argentina and you've never been there. would you really feel some obligation to travel down to Argentina to show up in some court there?
If I had been indicted in Argentina for conduct that,
that you did in the United States, you're at home.
Your Honor, we do not concede that. We do not concede that this is an extraterritorial case by any means.
He didn't flee the United. He didn't leave the United States. Did
no,
he?
We agree.
For all practical purposes, he's never been to the United States. This entire business relationship took place in Kuwait. He's a subcontractor of a contractor of the U.S. government. So aside from the emails, you don't have much of a link to the United States.
Your Honor, we have acts of a co-conspirator within the United States, opening bank accounts, attempts to deposit a $1 million draft check. Case law in this circuit, as well as the beginning of the conspiracy doctrine with Pinkerton, coming from the Supreme Court, was a scheme to defraud case, a scheme entered into by more than one.
It's not the mandamus issue, right?
No, it's not, Your Honor. I'm just trying to address Judge Woods.
Let's take the Argentinian case. Obviously, to be indicted by a foreign country, regardless of what your travel plans are, imposes a substantial cost. Hurts your business relations, and it hangs over your head. So I don't know why he shouldn't be able to get the district judge to rule on this. Why not? What's the reason against it?
First is the harm to the court's discretion in of itself.
Excuse me? This is not a matter of discretion. Look, it would be ridiculous to have a doctrine under which if a district judge wants to rule on a motion to dismiss of a foreigner, he can. If he doesn't want to, he doesn't have to. Right? It has to be a uniform rule.
I apologize if that's the way the court took what I was saying as discretion.
Sense.
What I'm saying is discretionary, Your Honor, is Rule 12D in itself. When it says that a court has to rule prior to trial, that leaves up until trial for the court to determine when
to rule. No, it doesn't make any sense to have every district judge in the country deciding whether people in Hijazi's position can get a ruling on the indictment or can't.
It just doesn't make any sense. He can get a ruling.
Yes, whether he has to come back to the United States to get the ruling. Come to the United States. That's the issue. That has to be decided for the whole country, not by individual district judges.
Your Honor, if it's to be decided by the whole country, then it needs to be decided through the rules process within the Federal Rules of Procedure.
If the person isn't a fugitive, he certainly has a right to get a ruling on his. If he has substantial issues about the validity of indictment, he can. We issue mandamus to tell judges they have to rule within a reasonable time on an issue presented to them.
When it's arbitrary for the court not to rule, and we do not believe
it's arbitrary if he's refusing to rule because he's invented an extension of the fugitive entitlement doctrine.
We disagree that he's applying the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. He's not being disentitled.
Well, he made up his own doctrine, then.
No, Your Honor, he is taking a factor and exercising his discretion.
No, it's not a matter of discretion. This is a general problem. Are people who've never been in the United States and are not fugitives, are they entitled to get a ruling without coming to the United States on their indictment? A ruling within a reasonable time. And a reasonable time is not forever, right?
I mean, the government's conceded that there's a standoff here, right? He can stay in Kuwait forever. You can wait for the arraignment forever. And actually, in the analogous situation where somebody's being held in civil contempt, waiting for that person to give evidence or do whatever, in that instance, courts have developed a doctrine saying after a period of time, I believe it's normally 2 years, it has to convert into a criminal contempt. At that point, your delaying situation has become permanent. And it seems to me it's a rough analogy, but it seems to me something like that has happened here. Maybe the district judge could have waited for a little while to see if he was going to come, but it's abundantly clear at this point that he's not going to.
Which, and I understand, Your Honor, but you're saying it's not discretionary. But this is why we believe it is discretionary, because what he's saying, in effect, is rule in my favor. I don't have to show up because it's in my favor.
Rule against me.
Rule against me. I still don't show up, and it's very clear.
Yes, but you're
from
wrong when you say in your brief that there's no harm to him, because if this indictment is upheld, and we hold, you know, he has violated American law, it's extraterritorial, then that changes his, that makes his position in Kuwait much worse. He can tell the Kuwaitis, look, some U.S. attorney in Peoria has indicted me for some crazy theory of, you know, violating the statute, which doesn't say anything about foreigners, people doing things in foreign acts. And Kuwaitis can say, yeah, that's right, sounds pretty flimsy to us. We don't have an extradition treaty, so we'll leave you alone. Once you have an adjudication, it's a valid indictment that he's accused of, you know, of violating applicable federal law, then the Kuwaitis may change their mind. The State Department goes to them and says, look, you know, this guy is very serious fraud. There was some question originally about whether he could be prosecuted under U.S. law. Now the Court of Appeals has decided he can be, and we want the guy back. He's taking a risk.
I believe. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Don't you think? Or am I wrong?
I don't believe the risk is substantial.
Why
as
do you
court
say
is,
you don't think it's substantial?
Because the tenor of the defendant's briefs in themselves, basically saying he's not showing up.
He will show up if Kuwait sends him to the United States.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. He may not even be in Kuwait to do that. If he's got dual citizenship or has citizenship in Lebanon, he may not show up. So I
think
there are other jurisdictions other than Kuwait.
That would be ridiculous. Do you think it's a matter of indifference to him what country he lives in?
I don't.
So that if he could get asylum in Namibia, you would say, well, fine, he can't go to Kuwait, can't go to Lebanon, can't go to France, but maybe he can go to Namibia. Or Pakistan, or Georgia, maybe, right?
I believe, Your Honor, the example I first used was Lebanon, which I believe Mr. Bartolomucci said he was a citizen of Lebanon. So I don't think that would necessarily be
sent
a
to
crazy
Lebanon, and Lebanon sends to the United States.
Because once again, any country can waive whatever rights it has not to extradite its own citizens.
That is correct, Your Honor. I think Kuwait is very clear, though, in just the record before this court in the petitioner's mandamus brief, that they have no intention.
That throws you into a different pile of trouble, because if, in fact, there would be a foreign relations incident, if the United States pursues this too much, I think in some ways that strengthens his argument.
But I believe the executive branch, the Department of State's in the best position, respectfully, and not the court, in those issues of diplomatic concerns. And I mean no disrespect to this court and saying
that. Well, have you consulted
that,
the State Department?
I have not directly. I know that there's been contact between our Office of International Affairs and the Department of State. And I'll give you a real simple example. The affidavit that I had to submit in support of the mandamus just to indicate what we had, or in support of our response, indicate what we had done to try to attempt to obtain Mr. Hijazi, not only went through our Office of International Affairs, but had to review by the Department of State, so we ensured that it wasn't offending to a sovereign nation such as the state of Kuwait. So this wasn't done in a vacuum by Greg Walters. It's part of our appendix, Your Honor. I have an affidavit in the back that I submitted.
If you have to litigate this on the merits before he appears, would you have to disclose anything that would affect your ability to later get him to court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Or anything that you wouldn't otherwise have to disclose under the rules of the procedure?
No. I don't believe, and to be frank with the court, if we had to, and I mean, there are protective orders that can be used in that sense, but I can't foresee having to disclose anything, given this fact that this case has been tried twice, and is pretty much out in public. The case against the co-defendant has been tried twice.
Now,
everything's pretty much a matter.
Extra question about that, though, along those same lines, because there are indications in the brief that this defense cooperation agreement that the ambassador refers to in his letter is a classified document, and since the government of Kuwait is invoking that, would it be necessary for us to review that document in order to come to a decision?
If this court were to rule on the
merits. Or the district court, whoever is, you know.
I believe the district court would have to have access to it. I personally don't, because it's not a need to know for me right now, but I'm sure that someone within the Department of Justice has it. I mean, I think that can be worked out with counsel. But, so, mm-hmm. To answer your question.
Okay, so potentially, yes.
In summary, we ask that mandamus not issue, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Walters. Mr. Bartolomucci, is there any time? 1 minute?
There are no material factual disputes that would prevent this court from addressing the merits of the extraterritoriality and other merits issues presented by Mr. Hijazi. Everyone agrees that all of the alleged conduct took place in Kuwait. The only domestic American conduct or alleged conduct was engaged in by the co-defendant, Mr. Maison. Importantly, this case was not charged as a conspiracy. There is no conspiracy count. So Mr. Maison's conduct in the United States cannot be charged to Mr. Hijazi. The claims are under the Major Fraud Act, the wire fraud statute, and there's an aiding and abetting claim. There is no conspiracy count. The government has had ample opportunity to brief the merits of issues in this case and has consistently refused or at least failed to do that. We have moved to dismiss.
Well, wait a minute. They got a stay or an abeyance issued on their motion, which would have held that motion indefinitely. So they didn't have to respond.
They didn't have to, but my point is that they didn't take the opportunity to do so, even though we have filed two substantive motions to dismiss and also a speedy trial motion. The government has never responded on the merits to any of these motions. Instead, they elected to pursue the strategy of let's ask the district court to strike or hold these motions in abeyance. So in a sense, they made this bed. They made the record in which their position hasn't been set forth on the merits, and they have to live with that, therefore.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Bartolomucci and Mr. Walters. Next case for argument.